Okay, let's see. So the plan for today is to do a few more examples of applications of the mean value theorem, in particular the generalized version that we proved that was related to parametric equations. So I want to do two things with that. So one is going to be L'Hopital's rule, which is fun, something you're familiar with and know. But the other one is going to be what I talked about last time, which is this Lagrange error term for the Taylor polynomials. And that's actually going to be something that we're going to do a lot more with later on. So that's an important thing to become familiar with. Okay, so today, let me just say again here. So today, generalized mean value theorem applications. And as I said, I'm going to start with the L'Hopital rule. All right, so let me just remind you of the statement. So recall this theorem. The generalized mean value theorem, which is, let's see, I guess it's 8.53. And remember, the generalized aspect of it was that it took as input two different functions. And let me try to use names that will be suggestive for my second proof. So let's name my functions k and g. So for all k and g. And for this generalized mean value theorem, we're going to end up taking one derivative. So they must be differentiable at least once, so d1. And let's see, let me put it on some interval ab. Okay, and then we'll be interested in its evaluation at two points inside of that interval. So let me take A less than C, and I'm choosing C and X advisedly because those are the letters that come up for the names of our points in the second proof. Then the claim is that there is some point, let me call it zeta, that lives between C and X so that the change in the value of k, so that means k evaluated at x minus k evaluated at c, so delta k times the derivative of g prime at this intermediate position zeta is the same as the derivative of k at that intermediate position times the change in g, so g of x minus g of c. So this a theorem that we have already proved. Okay, and so now, as I said, I want to make use of that. So the term for which I will use it is the is numbered, I guess it's 8.54. And it's the zero over zero version of L'Hopital's rule. For limits. Okay, so let me just write out the statement of that theorem, and then we will prove it. Let's see what I got going here. All right, so the statement is that if we have two functions, let me call them k and g just to agree with what I had before. And once again, we're going to end up studying things about their derivatives. So they got to be at least once differentiable, so d1, okay? And we're going to be looking at the limit somewhere. Let me just say it's defined on this interval with some point inside of there. Let's call it C. And we're going to look at the limit at C, okay? And so the situation that we want for zero over zero is that they're both zero. So K of C is equal to zero, and that's also equal to g of c, so they're both zero there at c. But we know something about a limit. And the limit that we know about, of course, is the derivative. So we know the limit of the derivatives. So the limit is x approaches c of k prime over g prime exists. And let me call it something, it's L. Then, of course, this is the technique that's so powerful in your Math 21. allows us to compute the limit of the original functions as x approaches c, even though they're 0/0. So the limit of k of x over g of x is also equal to L, right? So that's a familiar and useful fact from calculus. Okay, hope the statement's clear. So then I want to try to prove it, and I'm going to prove it using, as advertised, the generalized mean value theorem. And actually the other thing that's gonna come up, let me just mention it just so you bring it back into your mind, is Rolle's theorem. So that's the one that says that if we have a function with two values that are equal, then somewhere in between it has a horizontal tangent, a derivative of zero. Okay, so so let's start. Let's see. So actually the first thing I wanna do is over here, when I'm gonna apply this theorem, we're gonna involve this difference and the derivatives, right? And so let's start by looking at what that difference is, because that's easy and it's going to simplify what we're doing. So I note that k of x minus k of c is, well, let's see. So we set it up so that k of c was zero, so that's just a k of x. And similarly for g. Okay, so that's the case we're gonna care about. All right, and then the more interesting fact is this limit. So we know that the limit here is L, and we're trying to get this. So this is known and this is a question mark. So let's start by writing out in detail in terms of epsilons and deltas what this first limit is, and then check if that same thing holds for the second. And we'll be done, all right? So for all epsilon greater than zero, and there exists a delta greater than zero. So whenever I take any x with distance from c is less than delta, then we have that the limit that we're looking for, in this case, the derivatives, actually there's something wrong with this one we know about. So k of x, k prime of x divided by g prime of x, it differs from L by most epsilon, right? So that's the definition, okay? So now I want to try to do the same thing for this this one over here. And actually, as an aside, what I'm going to do is we're dividing by all these g primes and g's, and there's a little bit of an issue with zero. So let's just make sure we're not running into division by zero. Okay, so that's the first thing I'm going to do. So note, hence. Okay, well, let's just start here. We know we have this assertion that this number is less than epsilon. Well, in particular, that means this is a number, right? It's less than epsilon. It's gotta be some number, all right? Well, if this is a number, what does that tell me about this g prime of x?
Is that equal to zero?
Exactly, right. It's not, this is, we're not talking a limit or anything, but this is an actual number. And so, as you say, it cannot be equal to zero, right? So we know in particular that g prime of x is not zero. Okay, and that's gonna allow us to divide by it. So that's fine. Okay, but we also want that g of x is not equal to zero. So also, that's a little bit harder to see, but let's just work it out. G of x is not zero. And it's a parenthetical, let me prove it. Proof. So let's assume for contradiction that it is zero and see what we get. So assume for contradiction that g of x is equal to zero. Okay, and now we get to Rolle's theorem, right? So we know that g of x is equal to zero, but of course that's also equal to g of c. So what does Rolle's theorem tell me if I have that g of x is equal to zero and g of c is equal to zero? So I have this function, it's zero at these two points.
Then the derivative is zero at some point.
Mm-hmm. So some point in between here, let me call it y. where the derivative is zero, right? So that's and then that's what we're going to use. So hence, so by Rolle's theorem, there exists and this y, though, so it's pretty close to c because we know it's between c and x, right? The distance between y and c, therefore, is less than or equal to the distance between x and c, but that was less than delta, right? So I have this y, which is within delta of c, because it's closer than x was, with g prime of y equal to zero. And why is that a contradiction?
We already have that g prime of x is non-zero.
That's right. And we have it for every x, which is within delta of c, right? So this is, that's why it's a contradiction. Okay. Very good. All right. So we know that both g and g prime are non-zero at x. So we can divide by them. All right. So that's a little prep work so that we're prepared now to apply this generalized mean value theorem. Okay, so now let me just start and try to write out the result that I want. So the goal is to just write out this same statement, but instead of primes here, I want to just have k and g, and then I'll be done. Right? That would be sufficient. So let me try that. So hence, so now we just checked. So for all epsilon greater than zero, and I'm going to take the same delta as I have above, okay? So then whenever I have a y between within delta of c, then, okay, so let's see. So by the, now I'm going to use the generalized mean value theorem, okay? There is x between c and y, with the formula that we wanted. So f. Sorry, I guess it was k. So k of y times g prime of y, g prime of x rather, is equal to k prime of x times g of y. And remember why this is true. This is this part is this part over here, but the minus c goes away, right? Because let's see, where did it go? K of c and g of c are both zero, right? So when I go over and try to apply this theorem, this parts go away, right? Because we don't have any zeros there. So we're left with the k and g and the k and g, which is what I should have down here, okay? I guess I switched the rows of x and y. Okay, so, and then I can cross divide. G of x and g prime of x and g of y are both non-zero. So I have what I wanted, that k of y over g of y is equal to k prime of x divided by g prime of x. Okay, and so then I can just plug this in. So I can just use what I have up here and plug in my k of y over g of y, and then I'll be done, okay? So and so now this becomes k of y over g of y, and then everything else stays the same, so minus L is less than epsilon, and we're done, QED. Okay, any questions about the logic of that proof? Okay. It's a little bit tricky, but it's a short application of this generalized mean value thing. Okay, if there are no questions, then what I would like to do is the other application, which is the one that I talked about a little bit last time and said I would do today. And that is the, and as I just said, it's going to come up more. And that's this Taylor-Lagrange theorem. Okay, so let me remind you of what that was. So this is 8.46. Okay, and it says the following. So this time we have a function with lots of derivatives. We need quite a few for this to make sense. We need n of them. So for all f with at least n derivatives, so dn, okay, on some interval ab, and some values between a and b, so a less than c, less than x, less than b. So we have these values. And what we're going to try to do is figure out something about f evaluated at x by studying very closely what's happening at c, okay? All right, and in particular, all of the derivatives there. So then the claim is that there's some zeta between c and x. All right, with all right, so as advertised, I want to study the value of the function f at x. And what I'm going to compare it to is this polynomial that I wrote down last time. I'll write it down again, but hopefully you remember it from last time. And this is a degree n polynomial. It depends on what's happening with all the derivatives of f at the point c. So c is the point about which it's expanded. And then it's a polynomial in x, so I can plug in x. Okay, so this is my approximating function. And the claim is that the difference between the one I want and the one that I feel is easier because it's a polynomial is exactly equal to something, but it's equal to this n plus first derivative, okay, of zeta at zeta of f times x minus c to the n plus one divided by n plus one factorial. And I just realized that I wrote something wrong. Can anyone see what I must have written wrong? I just took the n plus first derivative of this function.
It should be d n plus one.
Correct. I have to be able to do that, right? Exactly. So I should have put it into a one higher space here. Okay, all right, so then so this is the claim, and let me just remind you of what P was. This is what we have. So recall, actually, let me add a little bit of notation. So there are two things. So first of all, this one I gave a name to, and I'm going to use that name repeatedly, so let me remind you. So this was R for remainder, and then I indexed it by the degree of my polynomial, the point about which it was expanded, C, and the point at which I'm evaluating it, x. So RnCx, okay? So that was the name for that thing. And then I will remind you what P was. So P is our polynomial, this Taylor polynomial, P sub nc of x. And what it is we're trying to understand f at by studying it very closely at c. So we're unable to do anything we like at c. So we have a f at c, and then we're going to look for how much it's wrong. So we're going to take a linear. So f of c times x minus c, and then we're going to keep going. And this n tells us how far we go. So we, sorry, f prime at c, and then we're going to keep going until we take the nth derivative, fn, nth derivative, evaluated at c. And the polynomial has this n, x minus c to the n, but then there's also a denominator of n factorial. So we wrote it down last time, and that's what that is. Just a definition. Okay. Maybe I will do a couple of examples of this, and then that I advertised last time, and then go to the proof. So some examples. Okay, so notice that what this involves, of course, is all these derivatives, right? So we need f, we need its first derivative, we need all the way to its nth derivative. So it's going to be particularly tidy and easy to work with this if we have a function whose derivatives are easy, all right? So that's the type of function I'm going to start with. So the example, therefore, that's going to be the easiest. Actually, what's the function with the easiest derivative? Not just my answer. Well, here's the one I'm going to use. So f of x equals e to the x, right? That's a pretty easy one, right? Because it doesn't change at all when we take its derivative. So that's a particularly nice one. So the nth derivative is just the same as the original function. Okay, so there's nothing. So that makes it a particularly easy one to work with. So we get that this polynomial p sub n c at x. So what is it? So the first thing, if we go back over here, the first thing we do is we plug our c into our function, all right? So that's our first term here. So that's going to be a e to the c. And then next, well, that's still e to the c. And then we have this term here, right? So this is a plus e to the c times a x minus c. Okay, and then we keep going. This is again e to the c, right? That doesn't change. And then we just have that term there. So e to the c and x minus c to the n over n factorial, right? So that's what that p is. And so a special case of that would be if I take say p sub four. So I'm gonna take the first, five terms, the first one's zero. So I'll do that. So p sub four at zero of say minus one. Okay, so what does that mean? So that means I just start plugging things in. So I have, I plug in this zero for my c, right? So I just have this x here and one there, et cetera. So the whole thing just becomes one, and then my x is minus one, so minus one, and then I have plus a half minus a sixth plus 1/24, and in other words, it's 3/8, so this is 0.375, okay? So I hope that's clear. So I just start plugging those in. I have my c and my x, and n is four in this case, okay? Okay, and so then if I look at my error term here, so this r for zero minus one, what does that mean? So that's supposed to be my function f evaluated at the minus one. So that's gonna be e to the minus one. And then I subtract off this p, and that I just worked out is 0.375. So I hope that's clear. So that's what I mean here by r. R is the difference between my function evaluated at the actual point I care about and this approximation. Okay, and the theorem says that it's equal to something like this. So I can just plug in the biggest and smallest values that this could hold, and I'll get a bound. So it's so this is then contained in. Okay, so there's the biggest and smallest values for my f here, and then there's this number. So what is this number? So I've got c is equal to zero, x is equal to minus one, so it's a minus one. N plus one is odd, so I have a minus over 120. So this is a minus 1/120 and minus 1/120. And the biggest and smallest values that I take when x runs from zero to minus one are one and 1/E. So I have that it's in between here. In any case, this is what the theorem gives me. And the point here is that's a smallish number, right? So in other words, this is a pretty good approximation to 1 over e, right? Which it actually is. If you actually check it, 1 over e is, if I just plug it into a calculator, I get something like 3.368. So it's not a bad approximation. Okay, so that, and the more terms you take, the better it gets. Okay, and you could do the same thing if you take, say, P4 comma 0 of 2. You can work that out just as we did above. You get 7. And then the remainder R4 0 2 is between, I guess, what did I get? 4/15 and E squared times 4/15. Anyway, it gets worse, but it's not terrible. And the more you do, the more terms you get, the closer it gets to the right answer. Okay, so this says that E squared is approximately 7 with error inside here. And you can plug it into your calculator and see what E squared is. It's not that far off. Okay. All right, let me just mention another example. F of x equals, another thing that's easier to take derivatives of is powers. So we can take a power of x. So let's take 1 over x. So fn is minus 1 to the n over x to the n plus 1 times the n factorial. We just keep taking derivatives. So our p, we can also work out pnc of x is going to be, let's see how much this comes. Yeah, let me put it on. So 1 over c, right? Because we first plug in c into our original function, and then we just start taking our derivatives. So it's going to be plus x minus c over, well, the second power, plus x minus c squared over the third power, et cetera. X minus c to the n over c to the n plus 1. Okay, anyway, you can try these. So try n equals 4, p equal, and say c equals, well, you can't plug in 0, right? So c equals, say, 1, and x equals, say, a half, or x equals 3. So in the first one, 1 over 2 is well approximated. In the second one, I'm sorry, 1 over a half, which is 2, is well approximated. In the second one, 1 over a third is very poorly approximated. Okay, so this 2 is approximated by, I guess it's a 31 over 16, which is pretty close to 2. And this is approximated by 11, which is a terrible approximation for a third. And it just gets worse and worse. Okay, so this is the thing to keep in mind, is that for one of these functions, it's just getting better and better. For the other function, it sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. And that's something to that we will see later. Okay, so this is the key point here. The takeaway is that this is very poor and this is good. And these are both good here. And so the difference between the behavior of those two functions is going to be a key point when we talk about limits of functions next week. Okay, any questions about what the statement of the theorem is before I run through the proof? Okay. All right, so for the proof. And as advertised, this is another application of our generalized mean value theorem. Okay, so that's what we're gonna want. Just like before, we're gonna end up with something like this. Okay, so, but the tricky part here is the choice of K and G. And it actually is tricky. So this is, it takes quite a bit of work to figure out what those K and G should be, but I'm just gonna tell you what they are. And so now you can check that they work, Okay, so that's the way that this proof is going to go. All right, so I'm going to tell you which K and G to try, and it's going to work. All right, and so here they are. So proof for the generalized mean value theorem, choose. Okay, so I'm going to take K of T equal to, okay, and it's a little bit complicated. I'm going to take R, which I already have, N, C, and X, and then I'm going to take a X minus T to the N plus one divided by X minus C to the N plus one. So just looking at, what is the variable there?
It's T.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right? And to all those other things that look variable-like, the X and the C, those are constants, okay? This is because the variable is T, okay? That's the key. So let's just, and let me just write down the other one. And G, we need two functions. And so G is equal to, it's easier to write down, but a lot harder to think about. This is gonna be R sub N and T and X, okay? So if I go up to what this R looks like here, here's R, it's this F, and then it's this P. X is just a constant, but the P is complicated because it's got that C in it, and I'm gonna put a T in for C. So everywhere that I see a C here, I'm gonna put a T, right? So there's a lot of T's over here. This is actually a fairly complicated function of T, right? Because there are all these different T's. So that's what my G is. And I should have written a G of T, which I will do now. Right, so they're both functions of T. Okay, actually, it's a little hard to read. Can we read that down? So, draw that T again. Okay. All right, and so now we are going to use the theorem. And so the theorem says that we have to understand what the value of both G and K are at X and at C, and what their derivatives are at some point zeta. All right, so let's start with the easier part. What are their values at X and C? Okay, so let's start with G here, K here. So what is K at X and K at C? Minus K of C, that's what we care about, right? Okay, so can anyone see what that is? So the tricky part is remembering what the variable is, or at least one of the two.
For X at zero?
Exactly, so do people see that? So if I take this one here, that means that I'm plugging X in where I saw a T here, so I'm putting an X there, right? So that makes this numerator zero. So the whole thing is zero, okay? So this first one is going to be zero. The second one's not zero, but it does simplify. So what happens when I plug in C for T?
It's just one.
Yeah, this whole thing is just one, right? Because these are equal. But this part's still there. So I have this RC of X times one. That's what I end up with, right? So, so this whole thing, and of course that minus sign. So I end up with a minus, and then I have R, N, C, X times one. So just R, N, C, X. Okay, and this one's easy. So let's finish up with K and then go over to the trickier one, which is G. So the last piece that we're gonna need up here is the derivative. So let's find the derivative. So K prime at T. Okay, and once again, the key to remember is what is the variable. So what is this thing in when I'm taking the derivative with respect to T? It's a big complicated mess, but it's a number, it's just a constant. Okay, so it just sticks out as a constant. So the only T happens here, right? So this is just a polynomial, and I can use my chain rule, and I'll be able to take the derivative. Just that one t, all the other noise here, all this stuff, which makes it look complicated, is constant, okay? So that's going to simplify the derivative. So so I'm going to be left with this r ncx, that's just a constant, divided by x minus c to the n plus 1, that's just a constant, all that's constant. And then I have to just use my chain rule here, so that's going to give me an n plus 1 times the derivative of my inside function, which is a minus 1, and then x minus t, the outside function, times to the power n, one lower power. Okay, so that's my derivative there. Any questions about that? That is an, that should be an easy derivative, because that one is just a power. Okay, just looks complicated. Okay, and then so now we need to do the same thing over here. So if I take a g at x minus g at c. Okay, so remember again what this g is. So g is r and here, and r has this f term and then this p term. Okay, and I'm plugging in x and c. So can anyone see what, say, the first term is? So the first term for k was easy. What is it for g? So if I take g of x, what is that? Right, so the g has this r, the r has this this sort of t, so I'm going to replace the t with an x, but the t is up here, it's a c, so I'm going to replace all these with x's.
So it's just f of x?
So we just get that f of x for the p. And then remember that the r itself is actually f of x minus the p. So I get f of x minus f of x, and then all the rest go to zero. Okay, so that's what that whole g is. So let me just write that. So this is f of x minus f of x. That's the first term. And then what happens if I plug in c into this? Well, it's just c, and we already have an rncx over here, so I'm going to be perfectly happy keeping an rncx over there. So let me just do that. So this is r. Oops, it's too small, it doesn't fit. So put it on the next line. So minus rncx. Okay, and of course that one's zero. So both of them are R and CX, okay? So these are actually equal to minus R and CX. Okay, and that's handy. So that means that when I do use this, finally get around to using this generalized mean value theorem, these two terms are equal. So what I'm gonna end up with is that the derivatives are the same, okay? So that's gonna be my upshot. Okay, so now I'm going to apply the generalized mean. I need one more term, which is the derivative. So let me of g, and that's actually the trickiest part. So let me just first assert what that is, and then do a short example so that it's clear. So claim: if I take the derivative of g at t, this is equal to, actually, can anyone see, first of all, why is this going to be complicated, unlike the other ones? So this term is part of my r, right? This is just a constant, right? So it's going to go away. But this one is more complicated, right? Because now I'm plugging in t here for the c, right? T goes down here for the c. So I have a t here, and I have a t there, 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 right? So there are all these t's, right? So when I take the derivative with respect to t, I'm gonna have a derivative here. That one's not so bad, but here I'm gonna have to use a product rule, right? So I'm gonna end up with two terms. And each of these other ones, I'm gonna have to use a product rule. So I'm gonna end up with two terms. There's a whole lot of terms when I do that. The remarkable and beautiful fact is that most of those terms cancel. Okay, so I'm gonna get a huge amount of cancellation. And all I'm going to be left with is this last one where I take this derivative and leave that one alone. That there are two terms in the product rule, and one of them is that I take the derivative of the first one, the other one is that I take the derivative of the second. The only one that's going to be left is this one. Okay, so that's my claim. So let me just write that down. So this is then equal to the derivative of that last term. So that's this n plus first derivative of f evaluated at t. And then the other part stays the same. So that's x minus t to the n divided by n factorial. Right? So that second part here of my term just stays the same. And that's from there. So that's my claim, all right? And let me just do a quick example of it, and then we can see why we're done. So I claim that two things. First of all, once you believe that, then the rest of the proof is very short and easy. We're almost done. We've done all the work. And so the second one is that that's true. And let me just do an example of why that's true. Okay. So an example. All right, so let me take n equals 2, because that's, I think, enough to see what's going on. All right, so then if I compute g prime of t, okay, so I just have to put in this g, and so what is g? So g is supposed to be, actually, maybe I'll have one more step here. So that's the same as r, so derivative. Maybe I'll leave that out. I'll just leave it here as g prime of t, sorry. Okay, so it's supposed to be this r. So when I go up here, I look at what the r is. It's got this f term first. So this should be f at x. Okay, and then I'm supposed to subtract off this p. All right, so let me start off with the p. So the p, the first thing is I've got this f at c, and c is my t. So this is minus f at t. Okay, and then I go on to the next term. So that's going to be minus f prime at t times x minus t. Okay, and let's see, that's going to be n equals 1, and I see I need one more term, so that's going to be minus the second derivative of double prime at t times x minus t squared divided by 2, and then, of course, I'm supposed to take the derivative. So is that clear? So all I did was copy the definition of g2 over there, okay? That's what that is. And the trickiest part with all of this is try to keep track of which are variables and which variables are what, right? So I ended up plugging in t where there were c's previously. Okay, and so then I just take that derivative with respect to t. And so the first thing just gives me 0 because that's the derivative of a constant. And then the second one gives me f prime of t. Okay. Okay, and then this one has a product rule, so it's going to give me two different terms, right? And I just have to work out what those two terms are. And so one of them is going to come from differentiating the x minus t. I'm going to put that first because that's going to be closer to what it cancels with. And so that's just going to be a plus f prime at t. And then I end up with a minus f double prime at t x minus t. Okay, so I end up with those two terms that come from that one. And sure enough, this is as advertised, I get a cancellation. All right, these two cancel. And then when I take this last one, I'm going to get the same sort of phenomenon. I'm going to have two terms again. And the first one's going to cancel, so it's easy to write down. I just copy what I had before. So f double prime at t times x minus t, that's what I get when I take the derivative of that second part, the squared term. And then when I take the derivative of the first one, I get the result, which is this minus f triple prime of t x minus t squared divided by 2. And as you can see, I made another mistake over here. I lost my minus sign, so let me put that minus sign back in. Okay. Okay, any questions about that? I hope that I didn't prove that this claim is true, but I hope I made it plausible and you can see how you would go about proving it. You would do basically what we did over here with an N sticking in there instead of just the 2. All right, pretty good. So now let's just finish up the proof and then we'll be done. So So now we can apply our generalized mean value theorem. So by the generalized mean value theorem, which is still just barely on the screen there, we have this zeta here that lives between C and X with the properties that we want. So there is, zeta between C and X with, okay, and let's see, so we're supposed to have this this difference here, so maybe I'll write out the whole thing. So I have this k of x minus k of c times g prime of zeta is equal to k prime of zeta times g of x minus g of c. But we just went to a huge amount of computation to see that those two things cancel because they're the same, all right? And so we're just left with those derivatives being equals. And so let me just write that out and then we will be done. So g prime of zeta is equal to k prime of zeta. And now I can just copy what we have up above, because we have minus f n plus first derivative evaluated at zeta of x minus zeta to the n over n factorial is equal to the other one that I already computed. So this is the, it's got the r in it, that's good. That's the thing I wanted to bound on. RNC X. Okay, that's the goal, is to get a bound on that, so that's good. And then we have an N plus one, we have a minus, let me pull it out here. We have an X minus, and let's see, I'm plugging in zeta, so that's X minus zeta to the N, and then I'm dividing it by this constant, X minus C to the N plus one. Okay, so that's just copying what I had up above, and I guess I renamed my variable zeta. It used to be t. All right. And so now we're done. This r n c x, when we do all our cross multiplication here, let's see. So these two things cancel. And we're left with the result that we wanted. So the n factorial and the n plus one give me an n plus one factorial. The f is going to stay, and it's just what we wanted. So this n plus first derivative evaluated at zeta. And then the denominator becomes a numerator, and we have x minus c to the n plus one, just as advertised. Okay, so there's the proof of the theorem, and about out of time, but are there questions about the theorem? It was a little fast, but hopefully you can run through it and see how it works. It's a good application of this generalized mean value theorem. But the takeaway, the thing to think about is actually these examples over here, because that's what we're gonna focus on next. And to think about these examples, this one and this one, to think about in what sense those functions are getting close to these other functions, because that's the next plan. We're going to, limits of functions. Okay, and it turns out to be a very powerful technique. The way that we study numbers is often by studying them in their decimal expansion, which is a limit of rational numbers. And many of the functions that we're interested in, so like this very wild one that I mentioned before, this continuous but not differentiable anyway, it's really hard to say much about it except that we can write it as a limit. And that enables us to do a lot of work with it because we can write it as a limit. And so so expressing functions as limits is going to be very useful. This is one way to do that, is these Taylor type expansions are ways to get functions as limits. But as we noticed here, we have to try to figure out what we mean by the a function approaching another function. OK, Okay, some of them do it in one way and some are doing it. We're going to give several different definitions, which are really different. And sometimes one is useful and sometimes another one is. Okay, so we'll talk about that on Monday. Okay, so I'm out of time. I'll stop the recording, but I will stick around for a while. Enjoy the weekend.